going to call to order the Civil on Data Practices Committee. Today is February 17th, 2015. We do not yet have a quorum, so we will wait until we have a quorum to, and I always forget to tell the video guy or the tape guy to start the tape, so I apologize. We will wait till we have a quorum to approve the minutes from February 12th. And we're waiting on some technology to get going here. Are we good to go yet? We're good to go. I've got the thumbs up. Okay. The purpose of today is just to have an overview of Minnesota medical privacy laws. And we're going to hear first from our House staff, Matt Gehring. He's prepared a packet of very good information for us. And then we'll follow up with a couple of presentations. Mr. Gehring.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm not actually going to make a whole lot of substantive comments about medical privacy and the content of the laws, but I just want to direct you to the packet that I put together for all of you. It's in the green folder, and then what I'm going to do is just sort of walk through what's in there, so hopefully you can find it useful as background as you go through the discussion and ask questions today. The first document that's in the green packet is titled Summary of the HIPAA Privacy Rule. So as you all may know, HIPAA is the federal law. It stands for the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996. This is the law that sets the basic floor in terms of federal regulation for the use and disclosure of health records by health providers. There's defined terms in there, including certain entities that are covered by HIPAA and entities that are not covered, and certain procedures for how data must be handled at the federal level. One of the important pieces of HIPAA that will be of interest to individuals in Minnesota is that it does allow for states to adopt laws that are stricter than what's contained in HIPAA, and Minnesota is an example of a state that does have stricter protections in law compared to what HIPAA provides. The summary of the HIPAA privacy rule is basically a walkthrough of the general principles that are contained in HIPAA. It includes a discussion of both who's covered, how they're covered, what types of uses and disclosures are allowed under the federal regulation, and then some penalties. So the actual regulation itself is not particularly user-friendly necessarily, but I thought the summary might be a good guide just if you have questions on how HIPAA works. The second piece that's in the green packet is a table that I put together that compares some of the state laws that we have related to medical records privacy here in Minnesota. The three big ones that I included are the Minnesota Health Records Act. This is in Chapter 144 and is effectively our state equivalent of the HIPAA law. Generally speaking, the Minnesota Health Records Act is stricter in terms of its privacy protections than HIPAA is. For example, there are more requirements in the state law related to consent that's required from individual patients for disclosure and use of data than are required under the HIPAA law. And if you have specific questions, I can go through those specific provisions. But as a general matter, and you'll probably hear this from the testifiers as well, Minnesota's law is generally viewed to be stricter than what's contained in HIPAA. The chart that I put together is just a basic summary of kind of the major principles of the records laws. And then also in the packet, I've actually printed out the statute. So if you go through and have questions about specific pieces of the Health Records Act or some of the other ones that I've summarized in there, you have the actual statutory text. The two other sections that I did print out for you are the medical data section in Chapter 13. This is the data practices section that applies to medical data that's held by government entities. So this would include hospitals that are run by government entities such as HCMC and others that are sort of public institutions. And then I also included a copy of the Genetic Information Act. So for those members of the committee that have been around a while, you may recall significant discussion about that section in years past, specifically related to newborn screening. So the genetic information piece is sort of a separate piece that's contemplated in the Data Practices Act, and so I've included that on the table and then also printed out a copy in your packet. In addition to the three that I've summarized here, there are lots of other sort of miscellaneous sections of state law that govern medical data in specific situations. So, for example, there's sections in Chapter 144 related to vital records and some other types of medical information. I didn't include those because there's lots of those, but if members have specific questions, I can help you find the sections of statute that might apply.
Thank you, Mr. Gearing. Do members have any questions about the information that Mr. Gearing's prepared for us? I would urge members just to keep this in your keep file because there may be a need to reference it, and it's or it would be good just to study this when you have, I know, a free moment. But it's good, really good background information to get a handle on how medical records are handled in the state of Minnesota or how they should be handled in the state of Minnesota. Thank you so much, Mr. Gearing, for preparing that for us. Still no quorum? Okay. We do technically have a quorum here. Representative Hillstrom has been in and out. So what I'd like to do is go ahead and approve the minutes for February 12, 2015. Representative Smith makes moves to have those approved. All those, any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes from February 12th are approved. Next on the agenda, protecting medical privacy in Minnesota, Twyla Braze is our first testifier. Please come forward and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president and co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. I'm also a registered nurse with experience in pediatrics and emergency room nursing, as well as a public health nurse. Thank you for taking time today to look at the critical importance of protecting medical privacy in Minnesota and for inviting me to present on a variety of topics within the issue of medical privacy. CCH Freedom has long been involved in protecting medical and genetic privacy rights. We actually began in 1996 when Representative Howard Ornstein took action to protect Minnesota medical records from researchers who wanted unfettered access, and we supported his consent requirement. For nearly 20 years, we have worked to secure patient consent requirements and limits on data sharing. Although protecting privacy includes limiting data collection and sharing at the government and the private sector levels, today I want to discuss three foundational steps you as legislators can take to secure our medical privacy rights. To that end, I'll discuss three situations specific to Minnesota. So first, as you're getting the documents that are being passed out, I will just say that Minnesota has a shining star in medical privacy that we should not allow to be undone. As Mr. Gearing said, we have a medical privacy law in Minnesota that is better than HIPAA. And although our set of privacy laws do not require patient consent in all situations, they are better than privacy laws in most other states. Furthermore, our privacy protections supersede HIPAA. Understanding the differences between our state law and HIPAA is crucial to understanding why Minnesota's law is worthy of ongoing protection. The so-called HIPAA privacy rule emerged as a result of the 1996 Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, otherwise called HIPAA. But HIPAA does not protect privacy. It is a permissive data sharing rule. Broad exchange of patient data is allowed without patient consent. The rule allows patients to request that their data not be shared for payment, treatment, and healthcare operations, activities with far longer and complex definitions than most would imagine, but their request can be denied. For a look at the payment, treatment, and healthcare operations, there is another document. Okay, thank you. The next one. Actually, the next one. There we go. Yes, thank you. And what you will find in there is, particularly for the healthcare operations, I believe that it is a 306 or 316 word definition. So healthcare operations is not a small thing. And if you look further into the healthcare operations language, you'll realize that each of, or most of the words or the terms within healthcare operations can also have their own definitions. So when we're talking about healthcare operations and the fact that your data can be shared unless you ask for a restriction, and even then your doctors can choose not to have a restriction, then you'll see how broadly your data can be shared. So people are often surprised by how many people can access their data. According to the federal government, 700,000 covered entities, as well as 1.5 million business associates, can potentially access a person's patient record without the patient's consent. That's more than 2.2 million entities, according to a federal rule. But that's not all. Government agencies also have access without patient consent for various activities such as oversight of the healthcare system, public health purposes, law enforcement, national security, judicial proceedings, and more. Furthermore, there are no consent provisions in HIPAA. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and I quote, "Mandatory consent was replaced with the voluntary consent provision that permits healthcare providers to obtain consent for treatment, payment, and healthcare operations at their option." So it is up to practitioners whether or not they want to provide this kind of privacy to their patients. So today, despite nationwide belief that HIPAA protects privacy, it doesn't. It doesn't even require consent for sharing. So this is where the Minnesota privacy law shines. Under the federal rule, states are allowed to have stronger privacy laws. As the Mayo Clinic states in the document I distributed, when state and federal privacy laws differ, and Minnesota law is more protective of your information or provides you with greater access to your information, then state law will override federal law. And thus, here in Minnesota, we have more consent requirements than most states. The quickest way to comprehend this is to look at the 2011 Mayo Clinic's multicolored notice of privacy practices. So this is the legal size document that has been distributed to you. And I'm sorry, but I don't have my own in front of me. But what I want you to do when you look at that is to see it more as a graphic than as an actual document for you to read. So if you look at the colors, you will see that all of the red portions are where Minnesota law differs. Thank you. So all of these red portions here are where Minnesota law differs from HIPAA. And most of them have to do with consent requirements that HIPAA does not have. So that's why the Minnesota law is so important. So for example, in Minnesota, the clinic and hospital cannot share your data for payment, treatment, or healthcare operations without your consent. So that whole list of healthcare operations cannot be shared without your consent in Minnesota. Fortunately, the Minnesota legislature has long protected patient privacy in many situations where HIPAA would otherwise eliminate those protections. But we do have some bad news on this account. Health plans and others want to repeal the Minnesota privacy law by requiring the state to conform to HIPAA. In 2013, a bill was introduced to do this, House File 824 and Senate File 970. The efforts of these groups continue. We oppose their efforts and will continue to do so. If Minnesota conforms to HIPAA, most of the red areas on Mayo's notice will disappear, and so will our medical privacy protections. Now to the second situation I'd like to bring to your attention. Minnesota has a situation that is exactly the opposite of our bright shining star, our medical privacy laws. Minnesota is one of only two states to mandate that every healthcare provider install and use interoperable, online accessible electronic health records. Massachusetts is the other. Minnesota's mandate in 144.495 also specifies that the electronic health record, the EHR, be connected to a government-approved health information organization. Thus, Minnesota mandates that every doctor, every dentist, every psychologist, every clinic, every hospital hook their patients' data up to the grid, a place where privacy cannot be guaranteed, as the Anthem breach of 80 million records proved. Now, first a word about electronic health records for your consideration. There is a perception that EHRs are a modern wonder, but physicians have complained quite publicly about how clunky and inefficient they are, how they hide important patient data, how they were never designed for patient care, and how they interfere in medical decisions. Jeffrey Shuren at the FDA has testified to 6 reported deaths and 44 reported injuries due to health IT, which he testified is likely the tip of the iceberg. But the most concise description of EHR angst came from National Nurse, a nursing magazine published and distributed by the nation's largest nurses' labor union. Here is how the executive director of National Nurses United described EHRs in an article titled, Questioning the Value of Electronic Health Records. First, she notes that the Medicare Administration concedes in a letter that they do not have any data that supports or refutes claims that EHRs save lives. Then she writes the following about electronic health records. EHRs and the clinical decision software systems that automate a patient's diagnosis, prognosis on whether to provide or withdraw care, and prescribe treatment protocols are increasingly interfering with the work of RNs and physicians, overriding their autonomy and professional judgment, and exposing patients to new risks of the very medical mistakes they were allegedly supposed to fix. End quote. The Minnesota mandate that every patient be exposed to EHR privacy and safety risks took effect on January 1st of this year. Every patient must have their data entered into an online accessible electronic health record, and every doctor and nurse is required to use that record no matter how much it distracts from or interferes with patient care. Now, regardless of your thoughts about the electronic health record, the most interesting thing about Minnesota's mandate is how unnecessary it is. Most doctors and hospitals in Minnesota already have interoperable electronic health records as a result of the 2009 federal EHR mandate. I call it a quasi-mandate because doctors and other practitioners can choose not to buy, install, or use an EHR. They will lose 1% of Medicare payments this year and up to 5% in the future, but at least they have a choice. Thus, with the federal mandate, there is some freedom. Doctors, dentists, chiropractors, psychologists, and other clinicians can stick with their paper record and its privacy. And in the end, it may even make financial sense. HealthIT.gov estimates the cost of installing an EHR system to be between $15,000 and $70,000 per provider, plus the thousands of dollars each year to maintain it. For some doctors, this cost alone has sent them into early retirement at a time when baby boomers are going to need doctors more than ever. There is also some freedom for patients in the federal mandate. Patients can look for practitioners who offer them the privacy of a paper record. I asked Don Lee, a Minnesota resident, to share his concerns about Minnesota's EHR mandate. Don?
Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name and position for the committee, if you would, for the day. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Don Lee. I live in Eagan. I've got a few words I prepared. I get nervous on these things.
No worries.
Good morning.
We're a friendly bunch. Go ahead.
I want to thank the members here today for their diligence and care. Medical privacy is a very big deal. And of all the areas of privacy, medical privacy is the most sensitive and the most personal. It is also the one that's being violated most egregiously with recent legal changes and mandates. Thank you for your work. I'm here today to tell you of my concerns about my medical privacy and that of my family. Laws like HIPAA purport to protect my privacy, but effectively grant access to my records to anyone in officialdom with reason to see them. Some may consider something private after half a dozen federal agencies have pawed over them, but that's not my idea of privacy. I don't value privacy because I have something to hide. My life is an open book. Medical records are pretty boring. That's not the point. This stuff is none of anybody's business. When I became aware that the law would force doctors to put my medical records online, I started trying to find a way to preserve my medical privacy. I found this to be quite a struggle. Hospitals, doctors, and even dentists are now under increasing pressure to comply with a blizzard of mandates and incentives. Doctors increasingly think of themselves as employees accountable to their institutions and less as professionals accountable to their patients. That would be me. Incentives matter. Institutions bend to meet the needs of those who pay the bills. For most providers, that's a combination of insurance companies and government agencies. Those third-party payers have little interest in my privacy, so they naturally place a low priority on privacy concerns. Data practices and record keeping are often separated from the practice of medicine, and so even getting a straight answer about how things are handled in the back room can be difficult. I've now found a small practice in St. Paul that shares my concerns and can meet my needs. They keep paper records. They're willing to promise me some actual medical privacy, and I'm going with them. My question today is whether the state of Minnesota will help me protect that privacy by leaving my new doctor to practice medicine according to his professional judgment and my preferences, or will the state make this difficult or impossible? The federal law is not in our direct control, at least not today. But state laws can make things better. Minnesota has done this and has one of the best laws on privacy, medical privacy, in the nation. I encourage you to continue on this path, using state law to improve the legal environment for doctors and those concerned with medical privacy. That would be just about everyone. Thank you.
Before you leave the table, are there any questions from members? I do have a question, Mr. Lee. The provider that you've found that is guaranteed to keep your medical records on paper and keep that safeguarded, what do they do with the insurance claims? They do have to send that out to the insurance providers. Do they do that via paper as well?
I presume so. There are no guarantees, obviously. I don't know. I haven't asked. Okay. And I'm not looking for guarantees. I'm not looking for someone who will take care of all my needs forever, no matter what happens. I am looking for a doctor, a professional I can consult for routine things.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from members? All right. Thank you for your testimony. Go ahead and proceed. Ms. Brace.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The January mandate for electronic health records in Minnesota caught many practitioners and smaller practices by surprise. Some of them are in the room today, and you'll see them because they're wearing stickers. There's a lot of psychologists and social workers and physicians here who they were aware of the federal mandate, and they exercised their freedom not to participate. Many of them did that, but they didn't know about the Minnesota mandate that took that freedom away. The impact of Minnesota's EHR mandate will soon be especially palpable for some patients. While everyone has their own definition of sensitive data in their own medical record, such as whether their cancer, their behaviors, their sexually transmitted disease, or genetic predisposition data could negatively impact their opportunities in life or the treatments they'd be allowed to receive, I think we can all agree that the conversations that take place during psychotherapy are highly sensitive and potentially and irreparably damaging if revealed. To illustrate this point, I have asked two licensed psychologists to share their concerns about Minnesota's EHR mandate. I'll ask Dr. Stephen Huey to speak first, and then Dr. Lorraine Carrisco. Dr. Huey?
Dr. Huey. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. I am Dr. Stephen Huey. I'm a licensed psychologist. I've been practicing psychotherapy in the Twin Cities for the last 30 years. Thank you for holding this very important hearing on privacy in Minnesota. Privacy is the foundation of the work we psychotherapists do. Suffering human beings bring us the things they can talk with no one else about. Our work cannot be done without the sanctuary of privacy. Minnesota has been a national leader in safeguarding patient privacy. Our privacy laws are stronger than HIPAA's and should remain so. Protections that have existed since the beginnings of psychotherapy more than a century ago should not be tampered with. With that said, a Minnesota law is significantly threatening patient privacy as of last month. It mandates that beginning January 1st, 2015, all healthcare providers without exception must use electronic health records, which by definition must be accessible on the internet. The January 1st mandate was passed back in 2007, well before online data breaches were regularly in the news. The the law has now become a severe threat to privacy in healthcare. In the recent Blue Cross Anthem breach, personal data including social security numbers and medical ID numbers of 80 million Americans, that's one in four Americans, were compromised. This was only the latest in a long catalog of data breaches, including Target, Home Depot, Staples, JP Morgan Chase, our nation's largest bank, the U.S. Postal Service, Sony, and numerous others. Internet security experts quoted on 60 Minutes in November and in major newspapers since the Anthem breach have predicted that matters will get worse. Digital medical records are a prime target for hackers, for example, accounting for 43% of all identity theft in the United States in 2013. Since 2009, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has recorded more than 1,000 medical record breaches of at least 500 individuals and 116,000 smaller breaches. Criminals use data from medical records to create credit cards, obtain free medical services, procure drugs, or blackmail people with threats of revealing private information. If your personal files are breached, the details of your medical and psychological history could be discoverable, unencrypted, on the internet indefinitely. Under the current mandate, no Minnesota resident can avoid this risk. In a survey conducted last month, 70% of Minnesota psychotherapists stated that if allowed, they would opt out of using electronic health records, and 70% expressed concern or extreme concern about confidentiality if using them. More than 5% said they plan to retire if forced to use them. Minnesotans should have the freedom to choose the level of privacy they want in their health care, and health professionals should have the freedom to secure their patients' privacy at the level they wish, rather than being forced to make confidential information fair game for internet criminals. Our state should not erode patient privacy, but continue to be a leader in protecting it, thus keeping inviolable the very foundations of psychotherapy and medicine. We ask for a simple change, not that electronic health records be abolished, but merely that patients and providers who choose to opt out may do so. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Grunhagen has a question.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your testimony. As part of my question, you answered already. I think if I heard you correctly, Dr. Huey, you said about 5% of current providers might retire early or quit the practice. Is that correct?
According to a survey taken last month, yes.
Yeah, I've heard some of that.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Manager. I've heard some of that same type of concern expressed to me by some providers. The other thing is the... you've covered some of the abuses and those types of things, but one of the concerns I've heard expressed is that electronic health records would cut down on doctor shopping. You know what I mean? In other words, people go around to different doctors to try to get certain prescriptions filled. And are there any safeguards in this system right now, checks and balances, that would help prevent that versus electronic health care records?
Dr. Huey, do you have an answer for that, or maybe Ms.
I don't have an answer for that. Do you have an answer for that?
Ms. Brace?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen. For one thing, the majority of the practitioners in this state already have electronic health records. There is this possibility that you say that you can stop this doctor shopping, but at what cost? At what cost to patients who refuse to come in, who refuse to reveal what's wrong with them because all of their data becomes somebody else's information? And so what we're asking for is really to just go to the federal mandate, which is giving some freedom to those who need it the most.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your response, Twyla. The other thing, my understanding is there's only two states that have this requirement, Minnesota and Massachusetts. Is that correct?
Ms. Brace.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, that is correct.
Representative Grunhagen.
I'm one of the, just a follow-up comment, Madam Chair. I was one of the insurance agents who had their personal information compromised by MNsure when there was like, what, 1,500 or 1,600 insurance agents' private information emailed to somebody in the state of Minnesota. So I prefer to err on the side of safety, especially with the amount of abuses, and I have little faith in a system that continues to be compromised both in the private sector as well as in the public sector. So I appreciate your testimony and input. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. Any other member questions for the testifier or just general questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Brace.
Now, Madam Chair, we'll have Dr. Carrasco, another licensed psychologist.
Good morning and welcome to the committee. Please state your name and position for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lorraine Carrasco, and I'm here this morning to share with you the reasons for my strong objection to the law that took effect on January 1st of this year, that every practitioner in the state of Minnesota keep electronic health records on their patients and have those records and all their data connected on an online interoperable system. I'm a licensed PhD clinical psychologist and Jungian psychoanalytic candidate in private practice in the state of Minnesota. My husband, an MD radiologist, and I moved here from Canada in 2001, and we have enjoyed working in Minnesota ever since. I have 30 years of experience in a variety of clinical and legal settings. I now work primarily with adults, doing long-term depth psychotherapy related to trauma, personality disorders, and so on. I am not a provider for any of the insurance companies. My clients choose to pay out of pocket to ensure confidentiality. The cornerstone of my practice and psychology as a profession since its inception has been the inviolate sanctity of the patient-therapist relationship. Breaches of confidentiality were, in the past, considered the most heinous of ethical, moral, and legal breaches, resulting in loss of licensure. That was as it should be. There were and still are very important reasons for the high value placed on client privacy. This law would force therapists to systematically breach that confidentiality. People come into therapy for many reasons, often suffering with intense feelings of shame, failure that make trusting and opening up very difficult. Building trust and a sense of safety is always the first order of business. The only thing that allows clients to even consider bearing their souls is the assurance that what they share will be kept absolutely private. If this law is allowed to stand, I can no longer provide this insurance. In fact, I would be ethically obliged to inform my clients that I would be submitting information from our private sessions to an electronic health record that is connected to a state health information organization, the security of which I cannot guarantee. This places me in a terrible double bind in which I must betray either my client's privacy or the law, neither of which I can do. Furthermore, I would have to inform them that there is also no option for them to receive confidential, secure treatment anywhere else in the state of Minnesota. For many, this law eliminates all access to secure mental health treatment, with negative consequences for clients, families, and all of society. For me, this law forces me to relocate my practice and family to another state or country that still respects and protects client privacy. When I have made patients and other therapists aware of this law, they have been uniformly horrified. Patients contemplate the need to terminate therapy, and therapists contemplate early retirement. One of my clients was queried in a job interview about previous psychotherapy for which she had used her insurance. The interviewers already knew private details of her therapy. She did not get the job, despite being amply qualified. This violation reinforced early traumatic experiences. Minnesota has one of the best medical privacy laws in the country because it has far more privacy, protections, and patient rights than HIPAA, but it has a mandate that doesn't give patients and practitioners a choice to keep private data offline and secure. Minnesota's medical privacy law must be kept intact, but the mandate for 100% use of interoperable electronic health records must be repealed. That patients should be forced into a choice between the pursuit of mental health or maintaining their privacy is, in my opinion, a crime. It's a violation of patients' right to privacy, therapists' right to freedom from coercion, and the right of all Minnesotans to access necessary treatment for themselves and their loved ones. Laws should protect ethical practices, not prevent them. Thank you for holding this important hearing.
Thank you, Ms. Carrisco. Dr. Carrisco, any questions from members? Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony. Found it very interesting. I'm just curious, you talked about perhaps having to move to a different state or country. Do you know about the surrounding states of Minnesota and what their laws are, say Wisconsin or Iowa or any of the surrounding?
Well, as far as I know, as has been said, Minnesota and Massachusetts are the only ones with this. I'm in a training program in Chicago, Illinois, and have colleagues in Wisconsin, and they do not have this mandate.
And Ms. Braes, could you tell us a little bit about some of the surrounding states as far as how they compare to our Minnesota privacy laws, our data practices laws surrounding medical records? If you can just touch a little bit on some of the surrounding states and how they might handle it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have all the information in all the states, but I do know, particularly because the good people at Mayo Clinic have done a lot of research because of the reach of their clinics, and therefore, if you look at a more current notice of privacy practices, you will see, as opposed to the one that you have in your packet, that's from 2011, and it talks about Iowa's law. But if you look at a more current one, you'll see that Florida has more protections than HIPAA, that Wisconsin has more protections in some places than HIPAA, that Arizona has some more protections. And so what I think is happening is across the country, as people are getting concerned about the reach of the electronic health record, that states themselves are choosing to provide more protection as they're allowed under HIPAA to their own constituents, to give them more rights within their state than HIPAA gives them.
Okay, thank you. Any other member questions? Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Carrisco. Ms. Braes, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with these two testifiers' testimony in mind, what our organization is requesting is that this legislature in 2015 undo the Minnesota EHR mandate, Section 62J.495, and stick with the modicum of freedom that remains under the federal EHR mandate. Now, I have one final situation to go over, and that is the patient consent forms. And I believe you have in front of you a consent form. Our office often receives consent forms from concerned patients around the country. And in the information I handed out is a consent form from the North Memorial Clinic, a system here in Minnesota. So I'd like to draw your attention to several concerns on that form. The form at the top is titled Consent for Services. And patients who sign this form agree to the following statement. By signing below, I consent to all of the above. There are, as you see, 9 items in the list above, of which only one is consent for treatment. And you'll notice that there is only one signature line for the entire form of 9 items. We call this a bundled or coercive consent form. If a patient wants treatment at North Memorial Clinic, they must agree to all of the following and more. Testing for HIV if a hospital worker is exposed to their blood, release of medical records for payment, treatment, and healthcare operations, release of medical records for research, release of patient records to the insurance company from anyone that has medical or other information on the patient, release of data to North Memorial from entities unrelated to North Memorial. So even though our state's health privacy law gives patients the choice of giving or withholding consent for such things as payment, treatment, healthcare operations, and research, this form does not give patients that option. To receive care, a patient must sign on the one signature line and agree to all of the above. In addition, there appears to be something missing from the form. Minnesota Law 144.293, Subdivision 8D, requires a consent form to include, at a minimum, a conspicuous checkbox option patients can use to exclude all data on the location of their medical records from a health information exchange and its record locator service. This is a requirement our organization secured in 2007 because the location of your records reveals information you may not want to reveal. You may not want your doctor to know that you went to a psychologist. You may not want your psychologist to know you have cancer. Whatever, there are just things you don't want these folks to know. So Northamoral uses a health information exchange according to its notice of privacy practices, but the required checkbox is not on this consent form. Now, I suppose it could be on another form, and I'm happy for Northamoral to provide that form, but I think it's doubtful given the comprehensive nature of this consent form. Thus, although Minnesota has one of the best privacy laws in the nation, some institutions may not be following all of it. So we suggest a requirement that institutions use a one consent, one signature requirement for every item on the consent form, making it clear that there is actually a choice to give consent or to withhold consent. This would go a long way to restoring the statutory privacy rights Minnesota patients are now losing as a result of the bundled consent form. So I will conclude my presentation today by saying patients haven't changed. Healthcare has. Patients still want confidential care, but HIPAA, the state health information exchanges, the Minnesota EHR mandate, and coercive consent forms have made it nearly impossible to find. Confidential care is not a luxury in healthcare. It's a basic component of good patient-centered medical care that protects against peering eyes and interfering decisions from outsiders. Protecting medical privacy in Minnesota means retaining our stronger state medical privacy laws and not conforming to the HIPAA no privacy rule. It means undoing the Minnesota EHR mandate and sticking with the federal mandate that gives some freedom and some privacy to those who need it most. Protecting medical privacy also means prohibiting bundled consent forms that deprive patients of the legal privacy rights that are theirs under Minnesota law. Madam Chair, I hope your committee will do everything possible to protect the stronger medical privacy rights Minnesota patients enjoy today and to secure the additional privacy they could have by lifting Minnesota's EHR mandate and restricting bundled consent forms. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to discuss these very important issues with you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Representative Kruenhagen has a question.
Thanks, Peggy. No, I'm just kidding. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your testimony, Twilight. Okay, when I look at this consent form from North Memorial, okay, let's just say I disagreed with one of the items, let's say D. I didn't want my medical records released for medical or scientific research without my consent. Could I cross that off and initial it and then sign the form? Does that have any legal merit, or is that not a correct way of dealing with this issue?
Good question. Representative now, I'm calling Ms. Braze.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen. Well, now that's a question of interest. I believe there was a study done some years ago about people making these kind of choices sort of off the regular way of doing things, and whether or not those institutions actually followed your choices, whether or not they had a system created to follow your choices. It's completely unclear and on that form that anybody could choose to do such a thing or how they would have that particular thing implemented. Very clearly, this form intends for you to consent to absolutely everything above it because it says all of the following or all of the above.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I was just, you know, this is my initial thought. Why not some type of a disclosure at the top? You know, if you create a separate form for everything, we'll be chopping a lot more trees down. But I was just thinking, what's the possibility of putting a disclosure at the top of the form right under North Memorial Clinic or somewhere at the top that simply informed the patient that if you disagree with one of the following items, you may cross it off and initial it. I don't know. What do you think of that idea?
Ms. Brace.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I do not actually, just to be clear, I'm not looking for a separate consent form for every one of these. Oh. I'm looking for separate signatures by every piece that you're asking for consent. therefore giving the individual a decision of whether to sign for that or for another. It would also be good to have a disclosure at the top which says, for instance, in order to have treatment, you have to do the consent for treatment, right? And maybe a clinic wants to say you also have to have responsibility for pain, and you have to sign that. But everything under here, the rest of these, are all voluntary. If you would choose it, we would like you to consent to them, but there is no requirement in order for you to still get care from us. Because, of course, a patient is vulnerable, and they do not want to create problems at the time when they're most in need of care. So they're looking at this, and maybe they're not looking at this because they're so desperate for care, they're just signing everything that comes in front of them, right? But they, at a vulnerable time, you don't want to get into an argument with those whom you are depending on. So it has to be very clear that you have the right to say no.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So in other words, if I understand you correctly, you'd be satisfied with a form like this, however, there'd be a signature and a date required under each item.
Ms. Bray.
Is that correct?
Either that, Madam Chair, or it could even be a checkbox initial here. Something where they know that they can refuse. They have to know that they can refuse. It's not just that they have a checkbox, you know, like, yes, I see I have read this, but I don't really have any choice to refuse to this. So a yes and a, or a no option.
Ms. Brace, how could a person, if that were to be the scenario then, how could a person find out from, say, a North Memorial whether their wishes were being adhered to? Who does an audit on them? Or Ms. Brace?
Madam Chair, HIPAA requires that you can go to your practitioners and ask for an auditing of, I believe it's payment, treatment, and healthcare operations, and who accessed your data that way. I believe in Minnesota there are also some auditing functions, for instance, who accessed your data for research. Now, we tried to get in 2007 more auditing provisions where you could find out everybody who had accessed your medical record for what purposes. And we didn't manage to get that through the Health Information Exchange. So I think you can still ask, and then you would find out to what degree people accessed your records. But to the degree that your wishes were complied with on something like this, I think it would be hard for you to ferret out, but people can try.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Ms. Braze for your presentation again. And maybe you've already answered this, but I really need to know again and have it verified in my own mind. If I were to go as a patient and refuse to sign this, could the hospital refuse to treat me?
Ms. Braze.
Madam Chair, that is a good question, because the only thing that you're coming there is for treatment, but this consent form would seem to make you feel like unless you sign and agree to all of the above, there's no consent, there's no treatment for you. So the interesting thing about your question is, because HIPAA allows individuals to not sign the HIPAA form, one of the things that our organization has done is we have a campaign to get people to refuse to sign the HIPAA form. Part of that is because signing the HIPAA form means nothing. Whether you sign it or don't sign it, your information can be shared as a state or federal law allows it to. But most people think, and I even had a legislator here once tell me when I asked, what does it mean when you sign that HIPAA form? He said, it means that my information is between my doctor and me. And I said, clearly you have not read the Notice of Privacy Practices, which tells you all the places that your data can be shared without your consent. So as part of our project, we have now just in December released a report, and I do have copies, and I could hand out those copies, with 12 personal stories of people refusing to sign the HIPAA form. And indeed, some of them were denied access to care. Now, the interesting thing about HIPAA is that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has a special webpage to tell doctors and hospitals what to do when people refuse, because the law says that they must only make a good faith attempt to get you to sign. But there is a webpage telling doctors and hospitals what to do when you refuse. So, you know, this would be, in essence, the same sort of trial as to find out what happens. Now, a lot of people have pressed those, and we now have wallet-sized cards that we encourage people to give to their clinics and hospitals when they refuse, with the URL to the federal website. And that has changed the minds of some of the clinics who have then allowed the treatment to go forward.
Representative Lohmer.
Representative Pinto, thank you for being the only Democrat to hang in with us today.
Madam Chair, I'll thank you, and thanks, Ms. Braze. Question, I guess following up on Representative Lohmer's question. So if a patient refuses to sign this form from North Memorial, can the health provider refuse to provide care at that point? I guess it seems like if the provider hands over the form and asks the patient to sign, a patient chooses not to, then could the provider refuse to provide care at that point?
Madam Chair and Representative Pinto, I would think that they could, because the one thing that you're also not signing when you refuse to sign the entire form is the consent for treatment. So in that case, I do believe that if you refuse to sign, they would say, we cannot take care of you here.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I guess, and the same thing for if a patient were to refuse to sign part of the form, because I can definitely see your point that the form does seem to indicate, you know, kind of it's an all or nothing thing, right? But if a patient were to exercise some of this or choose to sign part of it or not, could the health provider at that point say, well, you've chosen not to sign all of our form, that's fine, of course, that's your right, but we also would choose to not provide care at that point.
Representative Pinto, are you asking if they crossed out certain sections or if the form was different and it had the...
Sort of partial. I guess I'm asking if partial consent, could the provider at that point, the health provider, exercise their right to say, we prefer not to provide treatment in that case then.
Ms. Brace.
Madam Chair and Representative Pinto, as far as I know, and I would be happy to be countered on this, as far as I know, there's no law that covers this. And so I think it is up to the discretion of the healthcare provider. But I will say, just as to underscore one of the things that I have said here, is that in this state, under our health privacy laws, we have a right to consent or withhold consent for payment, treatment, healthcare operations, all these sorts of things. But this form does not give anybody any kind of sense that they have a right to not sign for these things.
Understood.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. And then one final question. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm concerned, we talk about changing the law, but I guess I'm concerned about making sure providers are following the law as it is now. And I see your point about the consent box, which I'm just seeing it in where you pointed out in the statute, and it's not in the form. Have you raised this with North Memorial at all about their form? Because it does, just from what you've described and looking at what you provided, it does seem like it should be there and is not.
Ms. Brace.
Madam Chair, Representative Pinto, that is on our list of things to do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Brace.
And I will add that for North Memorial, this would be very important, because actually Minnesota law has penalties for those who do not follow the record locator service statute. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Brace.
Representative Johnson. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Ms. Brace, I come from, looking at this consent form, I come from a different side of it. I come from a victim. Under letter B, the testing for AIDS and that stuff, I come as a victim of an exposure, where the gentleman who I was exposed by refused testing. I spent many years having that testing done twice a year, all because that gentleman who I ended up arresting from my previous career refused to do the testing. So I think it's important for the staff, if they get an accidental prick, they don't have to know who the person is, but that testing should be done for their own safety. So on letter B on this form, I think it's very important, if an accidental stick or something happens, that particular specimen be tested for those deals, because I've been through the anguish for years dealing with it, not knowing.
Ms. Brace.
So, Madam Chair and Representative, for some reason
Johnson.
I've just forgotten
yes.
your last name. Johnson, thank you, sorry. I understand your angst. I am a emergency room nurse. I know all about that sort of thing. But I also know about the hospital who accidentally got pricked with my blood. And what they did was they asked me, are you willing? And I said I was willing. So now what we get to is a point of, you know, who has the most rights here? Because what if you don't want to be HIV tested or hepatitis B tested or, you know, that sort of thing? So you were dealing with a situation of criminality. We're dealing with a situation here in the consent form of every patient that comes into the hospital for treatment. If someone makes an error, they will be tested, and then that information will be sent outside the state. They may not want to be tested. So we may just have a disagreement about the person's right to not be tested, and that's fine. This is up to the legislature to make decisions. My whole point is to bring up the fact that we have a consent form here that has all of these provisions in it without any choice on the person, on the individual.
Further. Okay. members, I think that the takeaways from this consent, and it's one of the ground rules of patient privacy. And I just also wanted to add, in your packets, you should have a packet of emails that were sent to my committee administrator, and one of those talks about an issue of a psychologist having the privilege to work with children off in the middle of high-conflict divorces. And, of course, this is an issue that I'm very involved with down here in the legislature as family law. And it talks in this letter or in this email about the very sensitive information that those children give, and then the parents who are in conflict getting hold of that information and using it against one another in a court. And so I think it's the ramifications of this healthcare access law are very wide-reaching and can cause issues that maybe we wouldn't think of just on the face of it. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I was concerned also about Representative Johnson's question in relationship to item B. And I guess if research could look into it, if they don't have anything else to do. No. No, look at the, we have public health laws, okay? Is there a public health statute or regulation that would require that when somebody's health endangers another person, that they have to allow medical tests to determine whether or not what the health problem that they have is communicable or not? Because we have, on my understanding, I'm a layperson, is that there is, under public health laws, there's a right to quarantine, there's a right to do certain things to restrict people's rights and freedoms in relationship to the general public health. So I'd ask research just to look in if there's a statute under public health or regulation that would could be used so that people like Representative Johnson would not find themselves in a situation of wondering for months or years whether or not he had been infected with a communicable disease. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. I'm Representative Grunhagen. I don't know if research has a take on that already, if you already know the answer to that question. Okay, they do not. They're shaking their heads no, so we look forward to the response to that. Thank you, Ms. Braze, for your testimony, and for those that were here testifying on, on behalf of how the effects of the electronic health records is affecting your business. For many folks, it's not affordable, and especially in the area of psychology and psychiatry, you're dealing with very sensitive information. So I thank you for that testimony. Next up, we have Manny Munson-Regala with the Minnesota Department of Health. He's already there in his chair. I look up and boom, there he is. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape if you would, please.
Madam Chair members, Manny Munson-Regala, Minnesota Department of Health, Assistant Commissioner for the Health Systems Bureau. Let me quick answer Representative Grunhagen's question about mandatory testing for infectious disease. The answer is no, there is no law requiring mandatory testing in order to protect healthcare providers. That is why the facilities need a consent in advance.
Thank you for that.
With that, Madam Chair, I thank you for the opportunity to share with you the perspective of the Health Department on the role that data plays in public health specifically. I will also take the opportunity to to respond or amplify on some of the observations that Ms. Brace and her testifiers made today. With that, let me start with a reminder of what the mission of the Department of Health is. We are charged with protecting, maintaining, and improving the health of all Minnesotans. That means when we think about the data that we use, we have this mission in mind. We try to ensure that the use of data is aligned with those objectives, protecting, maintaining, and improving the health of all Minnesotans. Now, in going through that process, we keep in mind the balance that is necessary to ensure that work. You are a committee of balance. You deal with the tension between, articulated very eloquently by the testifiers here today, of the need for individual privacy, balanced with the need to do certain work. My goal today is to share with you the work that we do at the department. But before I get there, let me discuss some of the items that Ms. Brace talked about today to provide you some additional perspective. Yes, Minnesota has significantly stricter medical sharing laws than required by the federal HIPAA law. That certainly means that patients' privacy here in Minnesota is more tightly protected than would be the case under federal law. That also means that more than not, their care here may be more fragmented, more redundant, and potentially more costly. Movement in one direction to protect privacy certainly has implications for the ability to ensure that their care is coordinated, efficient, and affordable. On electronic health records, let me provide some additional context. Ms. Brace and her testifiers have articulated the downside of EHR as well. Let me suggest some of the benefits. EHRs can dramatically reduce medical prescription errors, of which there are millions each year in the United States. If one provider has prescribed one medication, a second provider might want to know that before they prescribe a medication that creates some potential adverse side effects in combination with the previous med, that medication has been provided. When physicians make a referral, EHRs allow them to forward the patient's complete medical record and share their comments. For those of you who have had to deal with multiple providers with complex medical practices, oftentimes one of the ways you make sure that occurs is to physically carry big chunks of paper around with you to make sure that your new provider knows exactly what conditions you have. Not saying that that's certainly not an option people can use, but one of the things EHRs can do is to simplify that care coordination process. EHRs can reduce appointment time due to EHRs' easy sharing capabilities. And lastly, there's access for patients to view their own records. One of the things about having access electronically is that when you're at home, you can log on to a patient portal, like I do with my patient records, and I can see what shots I've taken, you know, when's my next appointment, my lab results, the kind of things I might want to know in order to inform my own patient care. Some additional points. A number of the testifiers today expressed the surprise at this law taking effect in January of this year. The law was passed in 2007. Ms. Bray talked about, you know, that she was part of the law being shaped in 2007. I'm a little surprised that providers are surprised. So, you know, not sure what we can do about that other than it's been the requirement that electronic health records be in place by the beginning of this year has been around for some time. Second, as Ms. Brace has made very clear, consent needs to be obtained from patients to allow for sharing of patient records. And with specific attention to mental records, you need a separate level of consent for there. The blanket consent for all records does not apply to mental health records or substance abuse records. You need a separate level of consent for those records. I apologize for not bringing this with me today. I wasn't sure what we were going to be talking about. But we have a Minnesota standard consent form posted on our website, which if you don't like a provider's consent form, our consent form must be accepted by providers. There are elements in our consent form that I suspect Ms. Brace might like. There are check boxes for the different types of data or information, so you can customize what level of information needs to be shared. There are time limits. there are the reasons for the information, that the purposes by which the information is going to be shared. And again, we will send a link of this consent record to the committee for their purposes. Much has been made of the fact that our standards are tougher than the federal standards. I would say that's actually a good thing in two ways. One, as Ms. Brace has noted, the majority of our providers, over 90% of them, are already on electronic health records. Why is that a good thing? Because under federal law, if you fail to comply with their standards, there are financial penalties imposed. What I would submit is that because we have worked so diligently as a community to get our providers electronically connected, that we are in a position to minimize the risk that our providers are going to be fined by the feds. Let me talk also about the sort of construct by which EHRs occur. There seems to be some confusion, and I apologize if we've not done a very good job on our side of articulating how this works, but electronic health records and interoperability simply means the ability for providers to exchange information with each other. These health information exchanges you have heard about are privately run legal constructs that only function is to allow for information from one provider to be exchanged with another in a secure, transparent way. More often than not, these health information exchanges, not run by us, by the way, but simply licensed and sort of monitored by us, serve the purposes of sharing that information. More often than not, they don't retain the data themselves. If you want to think about them, they act as a glorified conduit. They make sure the transaction is secure, subject to consistent data protocols. The word interoperability, I think, has been conflated with saying that this is somehow a way to ensure that all information is connected real-time and therefore accessible on the web to any hacker. Interoperable in this sense means that the systems talk to each other, not that they are permanently linked. That when you share information from your primary care provider to your oncologist, who then shares it with your radiologist, that the information standards are the same, that the data protocols are the same.
Mr. Munson-Ragala, I think there are two issues here, not just the fact that, you know, what you just said about it, it's just a way for providers to share with one another. There may be patients that don't want that, first of all. And second of all, for a lot of them, private, I know of at least one psychologist in my district that works from their home. And $15,000 to get a setup for a system is a hardship for a lot of people. And again, I think, and it also goes back to patient consent, but if every state was doing it, I might think, well, maybe there's something to it. But when there's only two states that are doing this and mandating this, I don't think we want to be the outlier on this issue. And I guess I would look for your response on that.
Sure. Madam Chair, thank you. So let me quick respond to the affordability aspect. Both the state of Minnesota and federal government have a fairly robust set of grant programs to help providers make the transition from paper records to electronic health records. So I would suggest that if you have an individual provider complaining about the cost, you might want to refer to the department because there may be a grant program to help them manage their transition. The second thing I would make about sort of that requirement, at the risk of pulling out a gun I don't have, our law has no penalties for it. If you want to think about our mandate, it's very much in the form of a strongly worded recommendation from our state. So when folks talk about, this mandate, I make the observation, at the end of the day, it's about their compliance. We'd like to think they see the utility and benefit of this requirement for their patients. But if they disagree, we have no authority to fine anyone for failure to comply.
All right, continue with your test. Oh, Representative Lohmer was first with her hand up, I think. It was almost a tie with Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Munson Regala. I'm just curious, when you were talking about the two separate, you said that mental health was a separate consent from the other, but is it still not required? Do they still not have to do it, whether it's one consent or two? I mean, they still have to report, they still have to put everything on the electronic medical record, so it's still available for people, is that right?
Sure.
Mr. Munson Regala.
Madam Chair, Representative Lomber, a couple of things in your question that I'll unpack a little bit. The law saying records need to be electronic does apply to mental health and substance abuse records. They have a separate level of consent that applies to them. If you want to allow those electronic health records to be shared, you need another layer of consent in addition to the standard electronic health record consent.
Representative Lomer.
Thank you. So you're saying that you don't have to sign the second consent so that those don't have to be shared? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Munson.
Madam Chair, let me read to you what we have in our standard form. Psychotherapy notes are kept by your psychiatrist, psychologist, or other mental health professional in a separate filing system in their office and not with your other health information. And then we boldface this one. For the release of psychotherapy notes, you must complete a separate form noting only that category. You must also name the professional who will release the psychotherapy notes in Section 3. And this is our standard consent form. Staff was very quick. They made some copies. If you can share those. And again, we'll provide a link. My apologies, Madam Chair, for not having copies for the full committee.
Representative, you're good. Okay. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Munson Regala. Who designs the software? It would sound like to me it has to be a common software that everybody uses the same thing.
Mr. Munson Regala.
Madam Chair, Russell Vogel, we have a e-health advisory committee that works with vendors in this space, because you imagine the vendors may have some opinions about which software platform should be used for all this data interchange. There are some national leaders in the space. There are two of them. We try to make sure that, to the extent possible, a provider doesn't have to pick one or the other, but rather that what platform they pick is able to talk to the other platform. Our intent is to try to ensure, again, with the feedback and input of our advisory committee, composed of providers, payers, pharmacy benefit companies, large employers, patient advocacy groups, we work with them to ensure that the standards allow for the transmission to occur, but we don't specify which platforms to use.
Representative Vogel.
So then the individual providers have a choice of software, or I guess my questioning is, if it's not standardized, then it won't work, so somebody must be mandating which softwares you could use as a provider. Otherwise, somebody would choose to say, I'm going to use this, and even though it's not compatible with what the database likes, that's what they would make a decision to do.
Mr. Munson Regala.
Madam Chair, Russell Vogel, so I will step on that very skinny ledge that a English major lawyer shouldn't step on and opine on technology. But the analogy I would use would be, we don't tell you which email client you should use. We make sure that the email protocols allow your client, whether you use Outlook or Lotus Notes, to be able to communicate with each other. So we set up the protocols by which that data is transmitted. But if you want to have an interface, a user experience that's different than your neighbor's, I think that's certainly within your purview.
And just one more follow-up, Madam Chair.
Absolutely.
So is there an ongoing maintenance then that the providers have to pay to be a member of this, or is it just kind of a one-time charge that they get a grant for? And my concern, of course, is that if you are an independent operator, that anything that adds to your overhead is passed on to the client, and therefore, depending on how this is done, would it be an ongoing cost for them?
Mr. Munson-Ragala.
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, the answer would be, I think, dependent on the licensing agreement of the particular piece of software you purchased. Some of the software, the business models for different software delivery firms has changed over time. In the past, you bought a piece of software one time, and then when it upgraded, you bought it again. Other business models include software as a service, where you pay a monthly fee and it is continuously updated. So I think the answer to your question, unfortunately, is it depends on how they bought it.
Mr. Munson-Ragala, I had a question, that is, you mentioned, I think you mentioned just now in passing that you were an English major and a lawyer. So you don't have an IT background?
No, Madam Chair. I've had the pleasure of having to work on very large IT projects, and I did work for an IT firm as part of my professional wanderings.
Okay, so you're not a complete novice. And one of the issues that I've found down here in looking at, you know, license plate reader data and all these other issues that we have, and talking to people that do this for a living, I'm finding more and more that the more that you transfer data, the more it's very vulnerable when it's transferred, data is. And so the fewer transfers that we can have, obviously the safer that data is. And I don't know with the Anthem Blue Cross breach if that happened during a data transfer or how that came about, but that is certainly one of my concerns. And I just to shift gears for a minute here too, this form that you showed us, and if you contrast that with the North Memorial form, you can clearly see that, and I don't know if this is if there's compliance. I mean, this form to me would seem to be out of quote-unquote compliance. Who oversees the hospitals to make sure that they're in compliance with Minnesota law, if anyone?
Madam Chair, let me check with staff on that. I suspect the answer is us, but then I'll have to understand what tools we have in any. And in fact, I'll be glad to meet with Ms. Brace afterwards to discuss any other forms that she thinks might be worthy of us taking a look at.
Because I would think that this would, if it is you indeed that you're supposed to be overseeing that these consent forms are done lawfully, then why hasn't that been done in this case? I don't know how long North Memorial has had this. This down here is dated 1/14, so I don't know how often you do compliance checks or whatever, but I'm guessing probably, too, that North Memorial is probably not the only one that has a form like this. So.
And it's also possible, Madam Chair, as Ms. Brace noted, there may be additional supplemental forms that are part of the patient intake process.
We'd be really interested in knowing that. Go ahead and continue with your testimony.
So, Madam Chair, let me make a pivot from talking about sort of the issue of data and talk a little bit about you've articulated some of the concerns around privacy. And I want to say that at the initial standpoint that we appreciate the perspective of people like Ms. Brace and her members. They remind us that privacy is an important component of the work we do. So I want to talk about the work that we do at the agency to ensure privacy is protected. The first thing we do is we ensure that the classification of the data, when it is being crafted in law, properly reflects its role as either public or non-public data. And we work with you members, particularly in this committee, around those data classifications. References to what portions of Chapter 13, which sections are the kind of thing that we rely on your help to help make sure that we know is this public or non-public data. Because any of the data that we retain, as you know, is presumptively public. The second thing we do is we work with informed consent. In the same way that providers provide consent forms, when we deal with individuals in the collection of private, personally identifiable data, we provide them a Tennyson warrant. And we make sure that they understand that the purposes and limits on which the data they provide us are going to be used. We've talked about a little bit about our technology standards and safeguards. We try to ensure that they are the most robust, that they can be within the constraints of working in any resource-constrained institution. But having said that, we try to make sure that the databases we maintain and keep are safe. We have also limits on access controls. You don't get access to, even me, all of the databases at the department. I don't think the commissioner has access to all the databases in the department. You have to have a need to know to get access to certainly some of the most sensitive databases in our meetings.
Mr. Munson-Ragala, how often do you audit for illegal or unauthorized access?
Madam Chair, I'll have to defer that to MNIT as to how often they do intrusion. I think you're asking two questions. One is how often do they regularly do sort of, maybe I'm assuming here, white hat hacking, right, to see how secure systems are. They do their own testing. But they also do intrusion testing or surveillance on a daily basis. We often get alerts from MNIT about certainly potential security risks that are out there, typically in the form of some innocuous-looking attachment to someone's email, and you'll get an email saying, please don't open any files with this attachment. So that occurs on a regular basis. We are fully cognizant, and certainly Anthem made it abundantly clear that the data we retain is of interest to folks with less than honorable motives, and that makes our team pretty alert in terms of making sure that we don't want to be in those headlines.
Thank you. And what about internal audits to make sure that no one in the organization is accessing data that they shouldn't?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do believe we do our own internal audit, but if I recall, in addition to that, the Office of the Legislative Auditor does a periodic, regular audit of our agency, I suspect with other agencies, on what our data protocols are. I don't know how regular that one is.
I would be really interested in the frequency of the internal audits.
We'll get back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So then let me switch a little bit to a question that hasn't come up today, but I wanted to give you a sense of there are times when data is collected and the question becomes, okay, you may concur that data should be collected, it should be retained, but why not have someone else, some private entity or some other institution, rather than a governmental agency like MDH, do that work? Let me share with you some food for thought. Not saying these are dispositive, but things you might want to consider. One of the times we're often asked to collect data is frankly to serve as antitrust safe harbor. When information is being shared between competitors directly, that creates some reason for concern among the folks at the Attorney General or the Department of Justice that those competitors may be engaged in anti-competitive behavior. The role then of a state agency like MDH in that space then is to provide a safe harbor to that data sharing. The second role why the government agency is being asked to deal with data gets to the crux of the issue that Representative Johnson talked about and Representative Grunhagen talked about. There are some times when the information is such that you need the ability to compel production. And the most clear example of that at the department is when we deal with infectious disease. In order to protect the health of all of us, we have to ask individuals some very intimate and personal information, like who are you? Who have you been in contact with? Where have you traveled? What have you eaten? What are you on? Data that we would otherwise not need, but for the fact that the answers to those questions may be material in helping us decide, do they pose a threat to the rest of the public? And how do we contain that threat? We're sometimes asked, and it's not unique to us, I'm sure other departments are in this role, to act as a referee. Multiple parties may agree that data or standards need to be set, but none of them want the other person to be in charge. So then they often ask us to step in the role of being that sort of mediator. We're sometimes asked to be the repository manager, curator, custodian of data, because there's a belief we can leverage our existing infrastructure to do it at cheaper scale than having another new entity build that capacity. The last thing I would share with you as to why the department plays a role in data is based on the statement my boss, Commissioner Ellinger, makes on occasion. He talks about data is a public good. Now, in economic terms, a public good is defined as a commodity or service that is provided without profit to all members of the society, either by the government or a private individual or organization. What do we mean by data being a public good in this instance? Well, I'll make a sort of pragmatic observation. You guys pay for a lot of that data. We taxpayers pay for a lot of that data. Almost half of our medical procedures are paid for by some government program, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, the Veterans Affairs. We should have the ability as taxpayers to know, is that money being spent wisely? Is that money being spent efficiently? Is that money being spent effectively? The second thing I would suggest is that in addition to the fiscal investment that we have in our data, data also has the ability to affect the health and well-being of every individual in our state. When we have data that tells us that we have cancer clusters, when we have data that tells us there's gaps in the health outcomes between different parts of our population, when we have data telling us that there are lack of access to certain providers in parts of our state, that helps inform our thinking about how we address those health issues. Access to data is rapidly becoming a determinant of health. The ability to understand what is causing and driving health outcomes is one of those key elements that you want to have. If you have a structure where access to that data is chopped up, truncated, curated, limited by ability to pay, we would suggest that that comes as a cost to the ability to take care of the health of all Minnesotans. And since that's our fundamental mission, is to manage, protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans, we would submit that when you charge us with data, that it be used for the public good. For that reason, we suggest some core concepts that you use in thinking about the data issues that pertain to health. Balance is clearly key. Privacy needs to be balanced with the need to protect health, the need to improve health, the need to maintain health. It's not an easy task, I grant you, but that's why you guys are charged with this mission. The second is I would suggest that when you're thinking about data in the public realm, it should be driven by the need to meet public goals. What is the core interest of the public? We would submit that if data is generated in part from public monies, it belongs to the public. And finally, we would submit that if it's public data, it should be made accessible to all so that all can use it. With that, Madam Chair, I look forward to any questions you or the members may have.
Concerns or questions? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your testimony, Mr. Pregala. What are your thoughts about the testimony that was shared regarding private practice people with this electronic health care mandate and the burden it places on them, plus the risk of sharing data that's put on a electronic basis?
Mr. Metzen-Ragala.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, so let me preface that by saying I'm the son of a doctor, the son of a nurse, and I have two brothers who are doctors and a sister who's a nurse. So I hear an earful about the transition to electronic health records and its impact on their practice. They will share that, they spend more time looking at a screen than they do with a patient. But they will also share, because of this, I caught this medication error. Because of this, I was able to get them into referral to a provider. They see that there are downsides to the work, but they also see the benefits. And on balance, I think they would have told me and would say to me is that, yes, it's a pain in the tuchus making the transition. This is not the way I practice. Now, I would say some of that though there are many people of, well, I guess at this point, my generation, that are technology savvy, some of that is generational. You know, my brother, 10 years younger than me, thinks nothing of having a smartphone in his hand. I recently had an experience with a provider, and God bless him, he looked younger than my daughters, but he, you know, had his tablet to look up drug interactions. So when he prescribed a medication for me, he knew, based on what I told him, what other medications I was on, you know, what elements were necessarily contraindicated. So I would say that I am sympathetic to the concerns of providers that they want to do and take care of their patients, and that moving and transitioning to electronic health records is an impediment to their ability to do that. I would submit that those concerns can be tempered by the potential benefits to their practice and certainly by the benefits to their patient. So I think, for example, Ms. Brace's suggestion that, you know, every single disclosure need to have a separate initial or signature, that would clearly be a benefit to ensure patient privacy. That would clearly be a benefit to ensure that informed consent was there. As someone bringing in a kid in for an ear infection, if I have to fill out a form every single time I come in, that would not be a benefit to me. I would go, I signed this consent form once. Aren't we done? When I go to the same provider in the same provider system, I go to the primary care clinic and then I go to the orthopedic hand specialist, and I have to fill out the same consent form because they don't have electronic health records in place to be able to share the data. That is not a benefit to me. As a consumer, I find that a remarkable frustration. So I get back to that phrase, balance. Yes, there are clearly costs associated with these requirements. I would submit that on balance, the benefits outweigh the costs.
And that is probably the position of the Department of Health. It may not be necessarily the position of everyone at this table or in the audience or in the public at large. I don't mind having to sign a form every time I go in, because if I'm going to a different provider for a different need, I want to have I want to be able to give adequate consent, and I want to see what I want to see the form that tells me about what information is going to be shared. And I think that is transparency is very important when it comes to health care. Representative Grunhagen, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Yeah, I guess, you know, I see where you're coming from, and I could see some of the potential benefits also, just as a layperson. But, you know, we continue to be exposed to these news reports of one breach after the other, regardless of assurances. You know, everybody says our data is secure, yet both public and private, we're having one breach after the next. So it does begin to beg the question of how secure is the system. And it seems like the hackers can be one step ahead of the protections that are out there to be able to access these this information. You know, it's a worldwide web, and I haven't counted the number of people, but it's in the billions lately. And I don't know what percentage are on the internet, but and a certain percentage of those want to make money off other people's data. So I just give you a little feedback in that area. Madam Chair, I just ask if, you know, he who speaks second sometimes has an advantage over the person who speaks first. And I'm just wondering if Twyla has any brief comments of regarding Mr. Regala's testimony, if she'd be given a few minutes to respond.
And I would welcome Ms. Brace back to the table. We can have a little back and forth for the next 10 minutes or so. I do have a committee hearing. I have to be at 10. Before we go to that, Representative Pinto has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Regal, I just want to explore the testimony of Ms. Carrisco a little bit. I think you were in the room when she was testifying, and she described that, that her practice, I believe she said, is not connected with health insurers. She sees patients privately, et cetera, and what she testified is that she understands that she is required to keep electronic health records. They have to be interoperable, et cetera. And so I guess my first question is it your understanding that, yeah, even though she and her patients have taken steps to not be connected, she is still required to do so?
Mr. Munson-Regala.
Madam Chair, Rosa Pinto, I think the answer is maybe, but I also think that the law allows, I think the law also contemplates and allows for requests for waivers. So I think that if a particular set of circumstances would suggest that the application of that law may not make sense for a particular provider, I know we've been engaged in dialogue with some providers.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like there may be some disagreement. I guess that's something that I would like to learn more about then, because if providers are required, as she testified, then I'd like to understand why, and if they're not, then it sounds like there needs to be some clarification from the department on that point. Mm-hmm. And then related to that, I guess you testified about a patient getting access to records online and the advantages of that, but of course that means that non-patients can get access to patient records online as well, potentially, if they can get a password, you know, all the dangers we've talked about. Again, is that something which is optional? Is that something where a patient could, if a provider chooses to not put, have those records be available online, and a patient chooses not to, the state is the state mandating that or not?
Mr. Munson-Regala.
Madam Chair, Representative Pinto, so I understand your question. Does online access to patient records, is that built into the system without the patient's request to do so?
Representative Pinto, is that the question?
Yeah, essentially, is the state mandating online access to patient records for patients?
Mr. Munson-Regala. You don't have to phone the friend. They just bring it right to you.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Pinto, no.
Thank you. I noticed there was someone in the public in the back here, and would you like to come forward and testify? Okay, why don't you come up and do that briefly, and are you come to the table if the page wants to grab another chair there. If you can give your testimony in 1 to 2 minutes, that would be great.
Okay.
And particularly if you would want to address, you know, you were saying there that the law says this, so if you could introduce yourself for the tape, that would be great, and go ahead with your
My name is Dr. Marianne Lassegard. I'm a clinical psychologist and a member of the Minnesota Psychological Association Governing Council. I've been in family and children's services, mental health services, for 30 years, and I have attended numerous trainings for psychologists and meetings with the department, Minnesota Department of Mental Health, have talked to them, you know, on the phone, emailed, have really tried to be educated along with other psychologists about what exactly is being required.
Mm-hmm.
I am concerned about some of the things that just were said by the representative of the Minnesota Department of Health as being very misleading. The law specifically says that that every health care provider in the state of Minnesota is required by law to have interoperable electronic records as of last January, and that is every provider, even if it's fee for service you pay out of pocket, that you have to do it, because the requirement is if you are eligible, and believe me, psychologists have asked this question in every meeting, finding some way can we secure privacy. And we have been told repeatedly, no, if you provide any service that is on a list of services that could be paid by Medicaid, even if you're not a Medicaid provider, then you have to have these electronic records. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've looked at it from every angle, and it's like there's no way out. You have to do this or you're breaking the law. And even though, you know, it's nice to hear that they can't impose penalties now, we are repeatedly in trainings threatened with this. There's going to be penalties. And, you know, we're very ethical people. We don't like breaking the law. We don't want to break the law. And we don't want to be lying to our clients. We start every session talking about privacy and confidentiality. I don't know when I'm telling them the truth anymore. So, and the other things that I wanted to mention very quickly, when he talks about grants available, there's no money for people in private practice. There's no money for people in small practices. The only money that's out there has been some grants for big, you know, if you're a big clinic and providing Medicaid. Otherwise, there's no money for us at all. That's just simply, you know, not there. And with the release of information that he talked about, the separate level of consent for mental health, that's only for psychotherapy notes. What is required to go on that record is a medical record. There, for mental health, is still diagnosis, your behavior, your thoughts, your behaviors, your diagnosis, your functionality, your dysfunctionality, all of that. There's no separate consent for that.
Thank you, Ms. Lasgard. And if Mr. Munson-Ragala would like to, you know, refute anything that was said there, we would welcome that.
Madam Chair, Dr. Lasgard, no refuting. Apologies on my end. No intent to deceive. A lack of understanding about the nature of the program. Staff was so kind as to correct me that Ms. Lasgard is in fact correct, that if you are a provider that is providing a service that would be covered by Medicaid, whether or not you take any Medicaid patients, the law does apply to you.
Okay.
Ms. Lasgard is also Dr. Lasgard is also correct that no mandate, that there is no penalty of assessment mandate, so I'm a little confused. I don't think staff would ever be telling anyone there's a penalty imposed. So if the trainings, and again, if you want to talk to me after this hearing, where these trainings are occurring, I'd be curious about who's telling you there's a penalty or other consequence associated with lack of funds.
Thank you. Ms. Brace.
Yes, Madam Chair and members and testifiers, you know, the fact is of the matter is that the law says, and I think you have a copy of the law in front of you with yellow highlighting on it, which says that on or by January 1st, 2015, all healthcare providers must have the electronic health record. There's no exemption in that law. It is a law. Now, the fact that it doesn't have penalties doesn't mean that you're violating the law. It might be a matter of time or penalties. It might be that someone says, well, you're violating the law, we won't give you X, or maybe we'll threaten you with licensure, whatever. Maybe they can say that they can't do that. But the fact is, a law is in place that says all healthcare providers. The fact that there's no penalties does not mean that there's not a law that everybody is required to follow. The other thing is, on the second page, on the second side of that piece of paper with the law on, you'll notice the part that says that everyone's health electronic health record has to be connected up to a health information organization. That is part of the law. You cannot just have an electronic health record sitting in your office not connected. It has to be connected under the law. So I think this whole thing about penalty or not is kind of like a red herring out there. It's a law. It says everybody. Penalties or no penalties, you're still going to be violating the law. Now, I have other things I'd like to say, but
we have 1 minute left.
Okay. Then, to be clear, this Minnesota Standard Consent Form, which I looked up online, has really to do with you transferring your data from one institution to another institution. It has nothing to do with coming to the hospital, consent for treatment, et cetera. It's all just if you want to transfer your data from one institution to the next, this is a form that you can use. This is not about consent for treatment. It's a completely separate thing. Tennyson warning, there's all sorts of places where the health department takes your data without any so much as a Tennyson warning. And so that is incorrect that the department always gives a Tennyson warning very clearly. A Tennyson warning says whether you have to provide the data, what happens if you don't provide the data, there's all of that. That doesn't happen when they take different kinds of data according to different kind of surveillance systems that they have started.
Grace, could you give an example of where they don't provide that?
Well, for instance, a real Tennyson warning actually says Tennyson warning on the top, and it has a warning. They should be giving you that for, let's say, the retention of newborn DNA or the retention of your immunization or your birth certificate, your birth defects. All of these different collection systems which don't have a paper handed to parents saying, Tennyson warning, we're going to collect this data, you have rights or you don't have rights.
Ms. Brace, I know you have more to say, and we are out of time. I do have to be somewhere here momentarily. I want to thank all the testifiers for being here. It's a very informative meeting, and with that, we are adjourned.